here I was, 12 years old, chasing drugs and doing whatever I had to do to get money.
In personal essays about what it's like to be addicted to drugs, 10 men and women tell of despair, depression, and desperation. Their essays came out of a writing workshop for recovering addicts at the Baltimore Drug Treatment Center, Man Alive. Through writing, dance, and art, they learned to express themselves in new ways. We'll listen as 10 people in recovery describe their struggles with addiction, from sorrow to hope, from prison to the street, and back again. Essays in Recovery, The Writers of Man Alive, on Midday after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In the middle of the journey of life, I found myself in a dark wood, for I had lost the right path. That's a quote from Dante's Divine Comedy. Throughout the next hour, we're going to hear the personal essays of 10 men and women who have felt lost in drug addiction. We'll hear in their own words what addiction can do to the mind, to the body, to their families. These essays are the product of the longtime Baltimore Drug Treatment Center, Man Alive. For about a year now, Man Alive has been running an imagination lab, that's what they call it, which uses dance, art, and writing workshops to help recovering addicts. For our purposes this hour, we're going to focus on the writing part of that program. The essays were recorded last week here at WYPR Studios, and as we listen to each one, we'll be talking about them a little bit. Don Reisett is with us. He brought us this idea because Don Reisett is a retired advertising executive and an author who's been working as the writing coach for the Man Alive writing workshop. So, Don, first of all, I want to thank you for bringing this to our attention and for being here today. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for having us.
And also with us today is Man Alive's CEO, Karen Reese, who is an addiction counselor. Karen, how long have you been running Man Alive?
More than four decades.
You've been there for more than 40 years,
Karen? I certainly have. Thank you for having us.
That's amazing. Man Alive goes back to 1967.
67, correct.
And it's located not far from here, really.
Maryland Avenue.
So thanks for being here. Karen, why don't you start us off by explaining the idea behind this Imagination Lab?
This idea was actually born out of a dinner conversation that a really good friend and I were having named Sherry Elliker. And I was telling her one evening that I had participated in a program that I created back in the 1970s that introduced dance and writing. And I was telling her how much I missed that innovative piece of treatment services. And the more I talked with Sherry, the more I realized she is the person to help me get it started again, get it off the ground, because she has all the characteristics that one needs to gain the trust of the people we treat.
I remember Sherry Elliker from WBAL Radio,
Sherry Elliker was from WBAL Radio, correct.
So she helps you get this started?
Yes, she and I are the co-founders. And when I looked at the personality characteristics that she shared, I thought she is an absolute shoo-in to help me not only get it launched, but to sustain it.
What did you think the benefit would be for people in treatment at Man Alive?
The benefit for people in treatment at Man Alive is they have such incredible stories to tell. And very often in the counseling environment, they're really talking mostly about the regulations and about what they have to do to earn take homes. And with outside people,
take homes meaning
take home medication,
methadone.
And with outside people coming in that really didn't have any clue about what methadone programs deliver, they came in with their talent, such as Don Reisett, who's a creative writer, and their compassion. So they weren't looking at them as drug addicts. They were looking at them as people that have this exterior on the outside, but they knew they could penetrate so much of what was going on inside. So the transformation occurred not just with the clients that we're treating, but with the volunteers such as Don and Sherry and some other people, and actually the staff. So the staff has gotten really involved in the Imagination Lab also.
So we're going to focus on the writing part, as I said here, because Don is with us, Don Reisett, who worked in advertising for a long time, and you worked overseas, you worked in New York, you grew up in Baltimore, but you're back here, and you volunteered to do this. So I wonder, Don, what was it like the first time you proffered the idea to people in recovery at Man Alive who are going through treatment about actually writing brief essays, writing poetry? What was that like? What was the reaction to that?
The reaction was incredibly positive. I mean, and the way the key was what you read earlier, Dante's line from the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, why does that have so special meaning to you?
Well, it has special meaning to me. It was the very first thing I ever shared with them, with the very first group in the middle of the journey of life. I found myself in a dark wood, for I'd lost the right path. And it meant a lot to me, and I knew it had to mean a lot to them, because they've all wandered off into the woods and gotten lost. And so from the minute I put those words up, I put them on a board, and they're literally in every meeting we have, in every group we have, those words are sitting up there, because they mean so much to them. And I also wanted to use it as a way to make them see a bond between myself and them, because like them, I've gotten, not through drugs, but I've gotten lost in the woods in the journey of my own life.
That's a universal sentiment, wouldn't you say? For everybody feel a little lost at some point.
So stepping off from that, I said, you know, what basically this is going to be all about is helping you to write your stories. And I knew that we all have a story, and I wanted them to have a chance to share theirs.
Well, we're going to listen to 10 of these during this hour, and so I want to get started and listen to one. Before I do that, I just want a note to our listeners to protect the privacy of these men and women who are clients of Man Alive. We have chosen not to disclose any of their last names. So with that in mind, we'll get started here. Just before we air the first one, I want to ask you this. What was the assignment? How did you state it to them? What did you want them to do?
On this particular, I think the first, this per, first
this
piece,
Priscilla.
Maybe the Priscilla.
So what was her assignment?
The assignment that day was, I wrote on the board, we are prisoners of drugs, struggling to find the courage to say no more. Some of these people I knew had literally been in prison, but all of these people had been imprisoned by drugs. And so my assignment to them was to write about the prison that drugs put them in.
So the first one we'll hear is from Priscilla.
Correct.
Physically, mentally, and spiritually bankrupt. I don't know my head from my feet. I'm locked up in a prison without bars. And in this prison, it don't feel real nice. No flowers, no bees, and certainly no peaceful trees. All I can think of is ways and means to get more. This stuff is killing me, slowly, slowly. And I know I'm gonna die. I know I need help. I need a release. But drugs got me locked up against my will. Willpower? There's no such thing. Once I invade my body with that one pill, coke or dope, there's no willpower against it. It's only a joke. One is too many. 1,000 is never enough. I'm trying to get that feeling that I had when I first began. It must be out there. I feel like if there's a hell, I must be in it now. Every day I need money to keep myself well. Oh, yes. I thought of something. Maybe I'll rob a bank. That's insane. But I've convinced myself that I can make it work. I'm at my bitter end. I have bottomed out. Do I go on the best I can until I die? Or do I try to give myself a new way of life? 2 days have gone by. I think I've licked it. But that monster tapped me on my back once again. Get up. Get up. Get up. Get me more. I don't care what you have to do to get it. Just get me more. I'm tired. Please stay dark. My soul is dead. There is no light. Somebody help me.
I've done my time. 21 to 50 something. This monster has used me and abused me. No more. Today is my release date. I'm free. I'm free. Thank God Almighty, I'm free. One day at a time, I bust my butt to stay free. If I forget, I will go right back in prison, a place I do not want to be.
Gee, that's really terrific. Boy, there's so much in that. Karen, that phrase, one is too many, a thousand is never enough, is that... Would you say that's original to Priscilla? I've heard that before from people in addiction.
You've heard it before from people in addiction.
Yeah.
But I'm very pleased that she actually chose to include it.
Yeah. And it's really, there's some beauty in that. Boy, there's a lot of power in that piece by Priscilla. Yeah, at times, Dawn, she's trying to rhyme. At other times, it doesn't seem to matter. But there's, it has a lyrical aspect to it, doesn't it?
There is. There's some beautiful things in here. Priscilla's a really wonderful person. But even at the very beginning, I mean, taking the financial concept of being bankrupted and marrying it with physical, mental, and spiritual challenges and problems is just a powerful thing.
The reference she made to 21 to 50, is she, are those years that
yes.
she's talking about?
Yes.
We're going to move on to the next one then. That was really good. Priscilla, we thank you for contributing that. Jeremy, also this metaphor of the prison, this is in his assignment too. So this,
yes.
this next essay from Man Alive client, Jeremy.
Being in this world, the whole of my teenage and adult life, I look around and I see what I've really been doing all this time. I thought I was expanding the horizons of my mind and expanding the frontiers of my thoughts. But I was really doing the exact opposite. What I was really doing was building the walls of the hypothetical prison we are writing about. The brick is well mortared, and my cell is too comfortable. But I have the makings of an escape plan, and this is what I need to be living for now. As far as the courage to say no more goes, it is okay to say ambivalence is the catchword that I keep coming to. Maybe this is a courageous thing I'm doing, but many days I feel no courage at all.
Okay, that's from Jeremy. Karen, another question for you. The clients at Man Alive. Now, some of these folks, I guess we can't talk too much about the mm-hmm. details of them individually, but they're on methadone maintenance. There's no plan to actually get off of that because that's how they maintain their lives, right?
Correct.
And they're reflecting on their time using heroin, most of them?
Mostly heroin.
So we would assume that about almost all these folks here.
Absolutely.
And people at Man Alive have other issues too, right? Some mental illness conditions, depression, for instance?
Yes, they do. And I've been in the field, as I said, for 4 decades, and I'm so happy to report that people are understanding that substance abuse disorders and mental health sometimes go hand in hand. And we're very fortunate at Man Alive that I created a mental health component about 6 years ago. So we have a psychiatrist on staff. But what I'm really looking to do with the Imagination Lab and with every therapist that works there is to break down their walls, because many of the times when they write about prison, they might not be talking about the brick and mortar of prison. They could be talking about the prison with using drugs. And you seem to be very well educated in this field. And I want to thank you for that, Dawn, because there are people that have to understand that you can be on methadone the rest of their lives. It is a chronic disease. And often relapse is not treatment failure. It just means that we have to tailor their treatment a bit. So thank you, Dan, for
that. Sure. You know, yeah. I mean, this is a problem that's been with us in Baltimore City for so many years. I say Man Alive goes back to 1967. I like the approach you're using here, and it's good for our listeners to hear what life is like for folks making this struggle. Dawn Reisett is the writing coach from this program at Man Alive that we're talking about. That's Karen Reese, who's an addiction counselor. So we'll take a break here, and when we come back, we'll hear some more of these essays from the Imagination Lab at Man Alive Drug Treatment Center. And welcome back. Dan Roderick's here. We're listening this hour to the personal essays of 10 men and women who've been through a drug addiction, our clients of Man Alive, the Baltimore-based drug treatment center in Baltimore, and got involved in this imagination lab that was established within the past year using dance, art, and writing workshops to help addicts cope with their struggles as they go through life on methadone and just trying to resist falling off and relapsing. With me in the studio is Karen Reese, who is the CEO of Man Alive and a certified drug counselor, and the writing coach for this program, Don Reisett. So my question for you, Don, was when these folks presented their essays to you or their prose or their poetry, what did you do? Did you try to make it better? Did you give them actual writing advice, or did you?
No,
your idea?
My role there is not, I'm not a writing teacher, per se, by any stretch of the imagination. I'm a facilitator. I'm just trying to help them get inspired to tell their stories. And so that's why each week when we get together, I give them a different kind of cue, and they run off of that.
You know, writing is not for everyone. It frightens some people. they find it very daunting.
That's absolutely true. But everybody really does have a story, and these people know they have a story. And the thought that somebody, even if it's just the other people in the room or myself, are interested to hear it, is a motivation in itself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It absolutely is. And
did they read these out loud in group?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. One of the amazing things about this, to me, because being a writer, I labor over writing. You know, I take a lot of time. Well, when I go in there each week, I give them, you know, probably 10 minutes of me talking to them about whatever to get them going. And then they write for about a half hour or so. And then we share together, those who want to, and usually a lot of them do want to, what they've written with each other. So the fact that they're pounding out these things that are really thoughtful and strong and metaphoric and a lot of these cases is just amazing to me that they can do it in, under the time pressures.
The next essay we're going to hear was written by Sharon, and Sharon, in her own voice, will recite it for us. And again, to protect the privacy of these men and women, we've chosen not to disclose their last names. So any setup needed for Sharon's essay, Don?
Just that she's writing about the thing that she believed drove her into this world of drugs.
I was blessed to have been born into a very Christian, caring family. From the ages of 3 to 15, I lived in paradise. But somewhere along the way, my paradise began to turn into a dark, unfriendly place, made so by one woman, my stepmother. Suddenly, my paradise became a personal prison. I broke out of that prison to find what I felt to be a new paradise. I began feeling the return of the love that seemed to have been lost, crushed by my dad bringing home the big, bad wolf to our once happy home. My new paradise began as a happy, fun place for me, but was very seldom there for others. For me, drug use and hustling became my escape. They helped me forget the pain of what was lost at home. I was happy in this new paradise, and I wanted to stay there for a long time, and I did. In time, drugs and hustling did for sure become another prison. But I was not strong enough to fight to escape that one, not for a very, very long time. Little by little, my desire to escape the drug prison did get stronger. Now I have a true desire to find the courage within, as did the once cowardly lion. Life without the use of drugs has finally begun to be that paradise it had been so very long ago. I lived enough, too much of my life in prisons.
That's from Sharon. Thank you, Sharon. Don?
One thing I would say about this, and this is one of the pieces that Sharon wrote, I guess somewhat early on, we build the stories week to week, and little by little, as they dig deeper into their life stories, they see things in a different light. And just this past week, Sharon did a piece that really for the first time, maybe her first time, made her see the big bad wolf, her stepmother that her father brought in a different light. And she wrote about how it really was, as she looks back on it, she realizes that it was her, Sharon, who was more the cause of the problem. Because she was so upset and angry as a young girl that her father's time was being shifted
to a new wife.
Person.
Yeah.
But it took her a lot of years to come to that point of view. It was just fascinating. The other thing I would say, the once cowardly lion comment in there, one time I got them interested in motivated in writing by sharing a poem with them that bottom lined out to people finding the courage within themselves and realizing that courage isn't just given away, that it's always there for us to find, that indeed it's all a state of mind. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that the cowardly lion finally realized, wait a minute, there's courage in me. I don't need somebody to give it to me. They really responded to that. They could see themselves in that, and it was great.
Thank you, Dawn. Karen, it must please you to hear people express themselves this way. They've been coming to Man Alive for many years, some of them. At the beginning of the show, you said how, you kind of get caught up in the bureaucracy of having a treatment center and people coming in to, get their dosages and find out whether they can have take homes, just going through all that and never really hearing much more from the personal side. Is that what you mean?
Yes, I do mean that. We're fortunate also to have the mental health therapist on staff to explore. I think she said something extremely important in the essay, pain and escape, because what you'll find with many people entering treatment is the pain that they've experienced in their lives. They are looking for some way to escape. So heroin becomes their escape mechanism. And so we process that through therapy. But having someone like Dawn walk in, who's non-judgmental, who doesn't really have any information about methadone, again, is just there to help pull out from them what's inside, has been phenomenal. They love Dawn. And when he was out one day, they were so upset. Where's Mr. Dawn? Where's Mr. Dawn? So he's become like family to them.
This is a great project, Dawn. You must be pleased with this. Let's listen to Lorraine's next, okay? And then we'll talk about this. Our next essay is from Lorraine.
I am a prisoner of drugs and of my mind, a prisoner of a woman that is seductive, cunning, and worldly. She seems to control my mind and my body. She makes me lie, steal, play games, and do things that I never thought I would. She made me feel like I should have been put in a room with the door locked because it was the only place I belong. She is always with me. But I have not quit. I will not quit. I will go on until I find the words, no more.
Mm-hmm. So Lorraine's there speaking about the other woman, meaning the other part, that this woman that lives with inside her that becomes cunning and lies and hustles because that's what you have to do in order to get money or to actually get the drug itself, heroin, when you're addicted, right, Dawn?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And she's had a, they all have, but I know Lorraine's had a tough go of it. And for her to come to the clarity that is so simply expressed in this piece is really powerful.
These folks, some of our listeners are probably hearing that they sound a little older, sound middle-aged and older. What would you say about the age range of the people who wrote these essays?
This age range, I would say between 45 and 50.
Okay. Wayne is next, and do we need to talk a little bit about him? Actually, this one, I have a note here that this is about dealing with prescription drugs.
Yeah, Wayne, one of the ways I got them started one time was I asked him to tell a Once Upon a Time story. And I gave him a little example of Once Upon a Time and some kind of Goldilocks or whatever kind of story. And they took off from that, and this was Wayne's Once Upon a Time story, which is quite quite fun in a way.
Once upon a time, there was this crazy man named Wayne who had the idea to join this group of people that ran fake prescriptions in Baltimore. My intentions was to make enough money to buy a used car. I had just gotten clean and was now in my recovery, so I told the two people in charge of the group that I wanted to join, but only under one condition, that I bust my scripts in Washington, D.C., Silver Spring, Maryland, and Annapolis, Maryland. Boy, I thought I was Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz going down to Wonderland. I bust up to 6 scripts in one day, within 2 hours, $600. Wow, $300 in an hour. It was a very, very long Wonderland with 6 Rite Aids, 5 CVSs, 3 Shoppers, 4 Giants, 2 Safeways, and 5 Mom and Pops. 25 total stores within 18 hours. I had cashed in 120 scripts. When I finally got arrested and the judge told me I was facing a kingpin charge, I damn near messed on myself. Actually, I passed gas so loud, I'm surprised I didn't clear out the courthouse. Being though this was my first charge, I had to do 51 days in the richest county in the world. It was like hotel, motel, Holiday Inn. Then when I came home, my mother told me, "Why did you wait till you turned 50 years old to become a damn fool?"
Wow. Wayne
always puts a little humorous edge on everything. Yeah. He's just that kind of guy. He's very, very deeply imbued into faith and family are really important to him. And his mother plays a big role in most all of his essays.
Well, the punchline is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he sounds like, of course, he's bragging. He's bragging in a kind of ironic way because he ended up going to prison, right?
Yes, indeed.
And when he was talking about the richest county in the world, he's talking about Montgomery County.
Yeah.
But doesn't that last line again? Why did you wait to become?
Why did you wait until you turned 50 years old to become a damn fool?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He the rest of that story, to borrow the old poor Harvey thing, is that when he's written about this too, when he was in Montgomery County's prison, he was going cold turkey off methadone. That's a whole other kind of story, and he has written about that as well.
Did he talk in the group with you about what he wanted to write, or did he just write it? Did he tell you, in other words, did he tell you that he had gone off to Wonderland and had this great run of bad prescriptions?
No, as I said, the impetus for this one was just, I want you to write a Once Upon a Time story. And I gave them an example of that, not a Goldilocks kind, but a real example. And then they all just took off from that, and this is just where he went with it.
There's a new one in there for me. I mean, I've heard people describe the physical excitement about being scared or shocked by something, but never quite that one before. But anyway, thank you very much. That was Wayne's essay. And Louise's contains some expletives that we bleeped out. But we need to talk anything more about that? Should we just listen to Louise's and then talk some more about it? Yeah. Okay, here's Louise's essay.
The day I started to walk on my path of destruction was October the 22nd, 1993. The year of my 27th birthday. I had been going through stuff with my husband, and I would always joke around about trying heroin because I knew quite a few people that were using it. But never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine really using it, much less falling madly in love with it. But that's what happened. This is the play-by-play of the day. I took heroin as my soulmate. I was sitting on the floor in my bedroom talking with my sister and a friend. We were discussing plans for my son and brother-in-law's birthday party that weekend. My son wasn't feeling well, and I had been arguing with his dad to take him to the doctor. Well, to make a long story a little shorter, I said to my sister and my friend, "When we had a party, I'm going to try some of that." My sister said, "Bitch, you always lying. Saying that shit, if you so big and bad, try it now." So to save face, I took the red bag of her when she was offering and took 2 sniffs of each nostril. That was the moment heroin became my lover, my mother, my kids, my everything. And before I knew it, my whole world was consumed with trying to get and use heroin, no matter what the consequences.
Thank you, Louise. Dawn?
Those last words, no matter what the consequences, they appear a lot in many, many of these essays. And I guess it speaks to the power of the drug, because once, as Louise's piece says, once she started with it, and going back to Priscilla's piece and the whole one is too many and 1,000 is never enough, you're in a place where you can't get out of, and you'll do anything you can to stay in it, ironically enough.
Well, Karen Reese, you've been at this a long time, so you're very familiar with the grip of that particular drug. Then we also had crack cocaine in Baltimore for a while. That was very addictive. But Dawn, I don't know what your experiences have been, but you must have been impressed by that. When you see that phrase, no matter what the consequences, people will do anything to get heroin. They fall in love with it, as Louise said. That must have impressed you, maybe to a level that you hadn't felt before.
Well, it certainly, like I said, it appears in so many, almost literally those words. They just filter through so many of these essays, so many of the times. They will do anything to get their fix.
I mean, because there's something everybody out here wonders about who's, first of all, never tried it, never done it, have no interest in it, have no one in their family who's done that, have not been through those experiences. You wonder, why? You know, why would you even get started? The word heroin is so scary, so frightening to so many people, but let's try it. I don't know. You've been at this so long, Karen. I mean, what insight can you share about that?
Again, what I like about the Imagination Lab is it's addressing it from a whole different perspective. There is a assumption that people that are addicted to drugs lack willpower, lack moral principles. But through the years, scientific advancements have shown that continued use of opiates, there are fundamental changes in the brain chemistry reward system. So the brain has been hijacked.
Oh, I understand the addiction.
Exactly.
It's the beginning. It's the first, it's just an experiment. It's not, innocently think it's not going to become addictive. What?
Well, I can speak about urban Baltimore, basically.
Right.
It's generational. We are now treating third generation at Man Alive. So if you're in an environment where it's prevalent and if there's lots of access to it, I mean, we're off Interstate 95, Interstate 70. I mean, we're the second largest seaport on the East Coast. So we have a prevalence of heroin coming into our city. And it's a larger problem. It's a sociological problem. People can't often get jobs because of their criminal background. I mean, you can talk about the layers and layers of the challenges that these people face. And when you talk about pain and you can escape it through an injection or snorting, a lot of times that's a choice. And it's a choice that stays with them until they themselves find their path to go on into recovery.
Karen Reese from Man Alive, the CEO of that treatment program here in Baltimore, and Dawn Reisett is with us, who's volunteered as the writing coach for that program at Man Alive. And we're going to hear some more of those essays when we get back. Another short break on Midday. We'll be right back with you. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here. In our studio, Dawn Reisett, the writing coach for Man Alive's special program at their drug treatment center on Maryland Avenue in Baltimore, where Karen Reese, also with us in the studio, is the CEO. And we've been listening to bits of prose and essays, I guess we call them generally, some poetry here too, from people who are clients of Man Alive and have been through drug addiction, through drug recovery, are on methadone maintenance, most of them. And took part in the Imagination Lab. That's what you called it. It just started in the last year, and Dawn Reese volunteered to be the writing coach for it. Now, The next one we're going to hear is from Brenda. This is a little longer than some of the others, but Don, any
the
any,
only
any
thing,
set up
the,
here?
Yeah, the assignment for this was to write about a day in that life, with that being underscored, meaning the life that they lived when they were addicted.
Okay, the first one we'll hear is Brenda's.
It could be any day and every day in the years from 1989 until maybe 1998. During this time, I was probably unemployed or partially employed but struggling. Usually, I wake between 7 and 8 a.m., and more than likely, the rest of my household is asleep. Before going into the bathroom to wash, I have to check my dresser drawer for my folded-up dollar or piece of paper, which contains my wake-up shot, to help me get ready for work or just to face the day. As I open the paper, I realize it's not the same amount I thought I stashed last night. Of course, no one has touched it because no one knew it was there. Truth of the matter is, each time my eyes opened during the night, I checked on this paper, which kept calling my name, and I snorted a little blow each time. Now my gate shot is barely enough to make a drain. Now the dilemma is how to purchase a dime this early in the morning without waking up others in the house. I wash and dress with thoughts of copping taking over before I can even think of spending my day working or watching the family kids. I do the little blow I have before long. A call comes in asking if I have any blow left over or any money towards buying dope. So my caller and I set out on our hunt. Usually I am in the dark as to who is selling what, but I can provide the money for our purchase, so we set up a time and a place to meet. After we make our first buy for the day, I either go off to work or back home to care for the house for the day. By noon or evening, it's time to start the tour of copping more drugs or conspiring to come up with the money to buy more drugs to get us through the night and be our wake-up shot for the next day. This has been an easy day. Later, I'll go into how to get high when I have no money.
So some insight there into what daily life is like. Kind of remarkable, actually, isn't it, Don? Because it involves sort of being part of the normal mainstream and then also being part of this underworld, this other side of life in the city.
Correct. Yeah. And also, it would be even more amazing if you had the chance to meet this lady. She is she just is a lovely lady. You would not look at her and think she had ever been a drug addict. But she has written a tough piece.
That's Brenda, and now LaTanya. LaTanya's essay deals more with family dysfunction.
I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood, playing hopscotch, riding my bike, and learning how to be respectful and play happily with others. I had a best friend, Lisa. We did everything together. I also had a sister. I loved playing with my sister and our friends back in those days. Everything was fun, fun, fun. Looking back, it was a fairy tale time. Around the age of 10, my mom split from my then stepdad, who had helped raise us. When my mom moved to a lower class neighborhood, I got hooked up with the wrong crowd. Over the next year or two, fun took on a different meaning. I started using drugs, stopped going to school, and noticed my life was going downhill. I wished I had never tried drugs, but there I was, spiraling down into a crazy world. I wish I could have just stopped, but here I was, 12 years old, chasing drugs and doing whatever I had to do to get money.
12 years old. That was LaTanya. A couple of things I note there. Family breakdown sounds pretty common in these stories that I've heard from over the years from drug addicts. Getting in with the wrong crowd and looking back and seeing that that was the case. This sounds familiar to you, Karen
Reese. Very familiar.
Yeah.
And the age of 12 is not uncommon.
To actually be experimenting in or getting involved in the life in some way?
To be getting involved in the life in some way.
But Don, anything you want to say or add about LaTanya?
Just again, there's the line, whatever I had to do, mm-hmm. which appears so much. But I also need to make one comment. One of the people that wrote a piece just the other day, since we're talking about 12-year-olds, her piece was about being pregnant at 13. And it was interesting. She wrote a line that said, you know, I didn't know how to be a mother. She said, and then she wrote a second line that said, I barely knew how to be a child. Hmm. Which I thought was incredibly simple and powerful.
That's Don Reisett, who ran this writing program at Man Alive. Karen Reese, the CEO of Man Alive. As we listen to a couple more of these essays, the first of the remaining two is Jimmy's, which does hint at some hope. Let's listen to Jimmy.
I started using drugs and going to prison around the same time in 1986. I have been in and out of jail more times than I care to remember. Each time it happened, I can say now it was because of drugs, one way or another. It always seemed to have something to do with drugs, no matter if I was using or selling them. The outcome was the same. I'd be home for a short period of time, then someone would take a chance on me and ask me to sell some drugs for them. I would start off doing well, not using, just making money. I was doing good, staying away from that person I thought might start me to using and going back to jail again. I didn't realize that person was always there. He never left. That person was me. I was imprisoning myself all those years, blaming others for what I was doing to myself. I was copying for my kid's mother and telling myself, if I'm going to go and get it, I ought to get some of it in return. I got tired of this ride. I had to stop this way of thinking. I had to do something or I might end up dead or very bad off. I had to get out of this prison of my own choosing and making. I had to choose life. No drugs, group counseling, or death. Heroin, pills, lying. I chose life, and I'm glad. I got on Man Alive, and the prison doors slowly opened. Every day now is a good day.
Thank you, Jimmy. Karen, that's good to hear. So Jimmy does what he's supposed to do. He's on methadone. Can we say that? We're not supposed to. Okay. So anyway, he's in recovery from drug addiction, and he's got some hope there. He lives a kind of a normal life.
Yes, he does.
Would you say? One other thing I noticed about what he said there was someone took a chance on me. This idea that you can come out of prison, having gone to jail or whatever, a prison for doing drugs or dealing drugs, come back out and maybe sell and not start using again, right? You've heard this one before, too.
Absolutely. I've heard this before.
That's a common. Well, yeah. I mean, you gotta get hooked into something other than that, like a job after prison. Don?
Yeah. That's what they have. That's the world they know. So they go back to it. And
yeah, but there's this idea that you could sell and not start using again, right? There's this hope or an ambition that could be.
There's a false belief in
there's
it.
There's a false belief.
Yeah, I guess that's it. We have one more essay to listen to, and this is Regina's. And then we'll listen to it, and then we can wrap up our discussion here. So, Regina.
I was around drugs a lot as a teen, from weed to drinking, cocaine to heroin. When I started, I had a ball, loved. But all the troubles and tribulations I would go through took me from the streets to jail. Getting high, trying to cover it up, slips and falls, and then trying to recover. I laughed. Looking back, thinking I look good. Skin gray as ash, losing weight, thinking nobody could tell. What a trip. That's the world I had created for me. I've been fighting for a while, but I won't let it control me. It's ugly to think now about all the time I spent chasing. For what? I lost a lot, especially a lot of loved ones that I really miss, pain, hurt and pain that I would not wish on my worst enemy. The good news is now I'm living my life on my terms, my rules. It's my way, as they say, or the highway. I'm almost at peace. When I get there, you will know. I will make sure that everyone knows.
I'll make sure everyone knows. That's Regina's essay from the Imagination Lab, the writing workshop that was run at Man Alive this past year. Now, Don Reisett, you're the writing coach. Anything you want to say about Regina? And then I have some more questions for you.
Yeah, well, Regina is a very strong, determined lady, but she's also very wary. She writes a lot, has written a lot, and is writing a lot about the trials and tribulations she has in her relationship with her daughter. It's interesting. She wrote something the other day. I made a note of it. She said she's speaking about her daughter, and she said she's hurt and shows it by the way she lashes out to me, meaning Regina. We're trying, but I'm scared it's going to make me use again to ease the pain. So as strong as she sounds in that and as triumphant as she wants to be someday to say, I'm going to let the world know, she's also very realistic and wary that there's potential pitfalls all around, and clearly one of the most sensitive and potentially most painful spots for her is in that relationship with her daughter.
Don and Karen, did you have a program or a ceremony of some kind where all these essays were read? Did everyone at Man Alive, if they wanted to, get to hear these?
Yes, we had what we refer to as the Imagination Lab demonstration, and it was held at the Lovely Lane Church, and friends and family and outside stakeholders were invited. And I honestly can tell you, audience members that had never been exposed to people in methadone treatment sat in that audience and started to cry because they couldn't believe the power of the writing. They couldn't believe the dancing. We did choreography. We have artwork that is being done there. It was just a very, very hopeful day. And the clients that are involved, as I said earlier, feel like they're more in a partnership with these incredible volunteers like Don and Sherry that come in here. So they feel equal. And I would like to at some point talk about the stigma.
We're about done, so go quickly. We only have like a minute left now, Karen.
Okay, so. The stigma of addiction has never been addressed. I mean, people continue to struggle with it. And our belief is that having the cultures cross, like people like Dawn and Sherry that, you know, walk in, they see these people very differently. They will then talk to their friends about it. The clients feel differently about themselves. So that's
okay.
I think we've met our goal.
Yeah. Here I was.
Yeah, okay.
12
well, thank you,
years
Karen. This
old,
has been really interesting. What's your takeaway from this, Don? What did you learn from all these people in 30 seconds or so?
That their stories have a lot of potential to help others. That's
in personal essays about what it's like to be addicted to drugs, 10 men and women tell of despair, depression, and desperation. Their essays came out of a writing workshop for recovering addicts at the Baltimore Drug Treatment Center.
Don, thank you very much for being here, for what you did.
Through writing, dance, and art, they learned to express themselves in new ways. We'll listen as 10 people in recovery describe their struggles with addiction.
So thank you, and thank you to all
the sorrow to hope,
who,
from prison to the street,
who read these
and back again.
For them, for
essays in recovery, the writers of Man Alive.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Karen.
On midday,
thank you.
After the news from NPR.
We're done. What's the matter, Karen?
No. I just wanted to say, if there's anybody out there to volunteer, just call us.
Okay. We'll see you, folks. Have a great afternoon.
Producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.